Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. As you know, we're all about business strategy, and many people have some great solutions that you have not heard of before. And if you're out there looking to start or grow a business, this podcast is for you. The book that we're talking about today is called A Whole New Strategy: Everything You Need to Think and Act More Strategically. And a business strategist, entrepreneur, serial entrepreneur, Nathan Shedroff is with us today. So thanks so much for being here, Nathan.
I'm happy to be here, Mike. Thank you. I've been called much worse, so I'm whatever you can manage. Yeah.
Well, it's I just saw it all over Facebook. 34 years ago yesterday, the movie Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came out. I remember being so into it, and there was the bad guy named Shredder. So maybe that was on the top of my mind while I was reading Shedroff. So my apologies for that.
No problem.
So, anyways. The book, A Whole New Strategy. You have multiple books, very much in the space of design, right? And there was one book that I saw, and I was looking at it, I'm like, how did he even get this approved on Amazon? Because you couldn't even know what the title of the book was by looking at the cover. And I'm like, this is fascinating. So tell us a little bit about the genesis of this book and maybe the pathway of becoming this serial entrepreneur that you are today.
Yeah, I've been a designer my whole career. And then I went to business school by accident, quite literally. And because that was like not on my plan to do, but it was a really great experience for me. And the entire time I was there, I had this designerly background and perspective. And so I'm a model maker. I put things together and try to solve them and turn them around and then try to make them clear for other people. And so ever since then, I've been mulling the tools that are commonly taught about strategy and trying to fit, you know, the things that these people talk about and that theory and that model and this to fit how it all goes together. And being an entrepreneur in the past myself several times, you know, I can weigh it against what works out in the real world versus what's in academia or what's in theory. And quite frankly, it is horrifying to see what MBAs are taught, or BBAs for that matter too, are taught in business school about how to do strategy. And so this book is the culmination of looking at that really intensely and trying to build a new model and a new process for it over the last 10 years.
Well, one of the things that stood out to me when I was just going through some of your books is in the very beginning of A Whole New Strategy, you talk about zombie companies. Yeah. And I did not hear this term until recently. I heard a guy named Patrick Bet-David talk about this on his podcast. Have you ever heard of this guy?
No, I haven't. I'll have to look him up.
Yeah, he talks about zombie companies. And so his definition, or maybe this is the definition, that zombie companies are those who are constantly relying on debt, right? They can't produce or create any type of income internally. They're always looking for outside money to keep them alive. And yeah. So that was what he defined it as. What do you mean by this? Because in 2019, McKinsey & Company, one of the most venerated sources of strategic consulting, published an eye-popping report on what they term zombie companies. So tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, well, so this report came out right before COVID, and I think that's why lots of people never really saw it. And the purpose of the report is to focus on this category called superstars, and that's the title of the report. It's saying, you know, what every CEO needs to know about superstar companies. And they term these superstars as the companies that are really responsible for all the growth and all the sort of value in the markets. Not all of them are public companies. Some of them are private companies. And they're only about 15% of all companies worldwide. And then they sort of offhandedly refer to the other 85% as zombie companies. And I think it's a little bit more than having to rely on debt to operate. There are companies that usually can service their debt, but they're essentially companies that tread water. They're not growing. They're not providing a lot of value. They're not going anywhere, or sometimes they're sinking. The big problem here is 85% of all companies, public and private, are in this zombie category. That's not a good thing. And it's not surprising, like you could throw out in the U.S., you could throw out companies like Macy's, right? Like, when's the last time you went to Macy's? Do you think about Macy's? They're one of these zombie companies. They're around, they're not going out of business, but they're not going anywhere either. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that it's 85% of companies should be like, that should be a national conversation, because that's not good.
Wow. Yeah. Like Kmart, right? Obviously they're gone. Right. And I think they're gone since this report in 2019, because it happened right around 2021, right? I think is when Kmart filed bankruptcy.
And you could say, I mean, there's a whole bunch. They're not all retailers. They're all sorts of companies. And of course, my point in the book is, you know, not only is this a bad thing, but most of those companies are doing strategy more often, buying strategy, and that strategy is not helping them. It's not getting them out of that 85%. And even if you went back to, you know, the famous book Good to Great that listed, I think it was Jim 20 Collins. Companies. Most of those companies are either not around, or certainly not on that list anymore. So I've been really interested in how do we help companies do better strategy, especially small companies that can't go pay McKinsey or BCG or, you know, even a boutique firm a lot of money. How do we help people make better decisions in that strategic process so that they can identify the best opportunities and maybe the most important threats so that they can prioritize?
Yeah. And I think that you have something along the lines of identifying maybe the four principles or four ways to decipher if it's a good or a bad strategy. And I think in what you talk about, Richard Rumelt's book, right? You have these four characteristics. Fluff is a form of gibberish masquerading as strategic concepts or arguments. It uses Sunday words, right? Tons of extra meaningless content to just have as filler. Failure to face the challenge, mistaking goals for strategy. I think a lot of people do that, right? Yeah. That's a huge aspect. And I think I'm guilty of that. And then bad strategic objectives. So is that pretty much your bottom line of, okay, here's how you know if it's going to be a good strategy or bad strategy for your company?
No, I think that there's a lot of perspectives that you can intersect into strategy, and they're all valid because they're all describing some aspect from some perspective. I think this is helpful, but I don't think anyone sets out to create fluff. So it's not really a checklist or a process. It's more of a diagnostic tool later to go back and say, hey, is this real? Is that real? How did we get here? So I'm not sure that it's it is absolutely true that there are these things that intersect strategy, but I don't think that you start from that as your process of making strategy. Essentially, you have to go back to figuring out, and that takes some research, what customers make their decision on, because that's the fulcrum of everything that follows in the strategic process.
And I'm looking at this and it says, how do we fix strategy? And in this book, you outline, this book will outline a better strategy that you can manage yourself. It will help you understand just enough of your market's context to set a strategic direction and translate that into successful tactics. The 7 laws of strategy. Could you outline some of those strategies on this podcast? I see a few of them. Strategy is about context and focus. Market issues should be separated from operational issues. Tell us a little bit about the 7 laws.
Well, so I've defined, I never put it in this book, but since this book's been out, I've sort of defined a periodic table of strategy, which is to say there is a set of elements that is the superset of everything you should look at. Don't have to look at everything. Not every one of those elements applies to every single company. But if you just have the superset in front of you, and if all you do is take 5 or 10 minutes and go through each one and say, hey, do NGOs apply to my strategy? Could they be partners? Could they be foes? Like, am I a retailer? Do I deal with retail? Right. Like, so especially in the stakeholder analysis group, just looking at each of these elements is really important and will likely identify opportunities that you would not have seen otherwise. So if you start with this sort of dashboard or panel or this periodic table of strategy, all the pieces are there in front of you. Then what you can do is move through those pieces in a much better sequence, because sequence is important here. In the book, I talk about like what most MBAs are taught about how to do strategy and therefore how it's practiced especially in smaller companies, but in surprisingly bigger companies too. You know, you put a team on positioning statements and you get another team to do a SWOT analysis, and maybe you have another team doing environmental analysis or competitive analysis or something. And if you don't do those things in the proper sequence, one after the other, you've just screwed up all your data and you can't make decisions. Because when those things come together, the frameworks and the perspectives and the things that were put into each of those, they don't fit together. So you just have sort of spaghetti. Another one of the sort of laws here, or the things that we need to do to change strategy, is we have to separate the market sequence or the market issues from the operational issues. And the reason for this is very often, like if you do a SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, operations, and threats, how this is done in practice is, you know, you have sort of you and your compatriots sitting in a room with a whiteboard and you draw the, you know, cross diagram and you just start listing things. But if you're mixing market and operational things, then you can't separate the decisions between what you need to operate in the market and the best opportunities there and what you need to deal with in terms of operations. And because we're all human and we have responsibilities in the company, we tend to overemphasize or prioritize the operational things because we have day-to-day responsibilities around them, which means the market issues and opportunities get deprioritized in a process like that and sometimes disappear altogether. So now you're making decisions that improve the operations of your company without any input or, you know, at least appropriate weight given to what the market's telling you and what customers and competitors are telling you. That's clearly not a good strategy.
Yeah. And I guess maybe this is for the first time I'm even thinking about this, but you talk about military strategy in your book, and there's situational awareness, which I think you touched on a little bit, is understanding your surroundings, right? And I think that when you first get into business, this is what all you have, right? Who are my enemies? Who are my allies? What do I have here, right? What do I have that's at my disposal? What can I offer the world? And then you have operational awareness as you grow. And so combining the two is really what makes you an absolute force in the marketplace. So I'm assuming this is what you teach, is basically marrying the two the right way.
Absolutely. And I don't usually put them in military terms, but, you know,
it's
like
a great way to put it, though. I like it.
It's a helpful way of looking at it. And also, if you look at the military, they're not just, you know, they're not myopic about themselves. They're looking at the whole playing field, the whole battlefield, right? And that wider context is what many people need to do with their companies, because they're not asking the right questions and they're not looking at all the right pieces. You know, it's sort of like playing Risk, but only looking, you know, 2 inches or 3 inches away from your pieces at any given time and not seeing the whole board. Another thing that pops out of this is, I have a little sidebar on Porter's Five Forces. This is another famous strategy technique that's taught in schools. And, you know, there's five forces or five players that Porter talks about, like, you need to be on top of. And, you know, one of them is about customers and their decision-making and bargaining power and the bargaining power of suppliers versus competitors and customers and, you know, the threat of new entries, et cetera. And that's all great, but it's part of this problem of why strategy is taught so poorly. It's so oversimplified into five forces that when you look at the periodic table of strategy or this entire dashboard, you learn, oh, no, there's 38 forces. Like, any one of these places is where something can happen. An NGO can knock you like they knocked, you know, Nike for slave labor and child labor, et cetera. It's not just suppliers. It's policy. It's lawmakers. It's your neighbors, your physical neighbors can be a friend or foe, right? Like, so why would you limit your view to these five just because that's what you learned in business school, when clearly there's more things that you need to keep your eye on? And again, you don't have to take days and weeks on each of one of these things. Sometimes a good 5 or 10 minute discussion among, you know, your cadre of people in your company, maybe some advisors that have views outside of what you see can either identify opportunities or threats, or maybe the answer is, oh, no, we don't have to worry about this. Let's move on.
Man, so you're making me think about the early days of entrepreneurship to where we're at now. And I will tell you that when I first started business, I had so much, and I still have a lot of grit and just angst and these the ability to want to run through walls, right? And I always thought, man, if I show the marketplace my ability to problem solve and just the willingness to help, it's going to open up for me and the world's going to change and I'll get everything I want. That's not the case. I was not thinking strategically at all. Yep. And as time went on, I became more strategic. And it's funny that, you know, I would build businesses in a way that even if it didn't make a profit, but got me attention for my other businesses, then that was still a win. So I became very much a chess player in this game. So
yeah,
I'm assuming this is something you see amongst entrepreneurs starting out. They're all about piss and vinegar, right? And then as time goes on, they become more wise. They become a better poker player and evolving into this formidable force. So is this something very, hopefully, right? Something that I've thought about too, and maybe this is where you can kind of clear some things up for us, is that I think that many people are always thinking of revenue or money as the as everything has to go to that right out of the gate. A short-term action leads to a windfall right away. And I think that the smarter I get in this game, I think it's all about being around for the long haul. And sometimes my strategy doesn't turn into money right away, but it starts to lay the groundwork for insane returns a year from now, 2 years from now. How hard is that to try to convey that to other people? And is that the right path? It might be the wrong path. What would you say about that?
Well, I mean, it's all about balance, right? Like there's so many things that you just said that are really valuable and insightful. One is like, yeah, revenue is incredibly important because if you can't stay in business, you're not in business, right? The first thing they teach you in sustainable business school, which is where I got my MBA, is if you can't stay in business, it doesn't matter what you're trying to achieve and how sustainable you're going to make the world, you're out of business. So there is a very real need to, you know, be on top of the numbers and care about revenue. You can't just put it off. And at the same time, you have to balance those impulses with the understanding that, you know, if you want to create a high value business, especially if you want to create, you know, a valuable brand, the world you're playing in isn't in numbers and features. And another problem that is taught constantly in business school is it's all about price and performance, price and features. It's all about sort of the functional, quantitative part of the business. Whereas what you're really building, if you want long-term, is relationships, right?
Yes.
And what most people don't understand is they're in the relationship business. It's not a special group of companies. It's not just high status, you know, high profit companies. Everyone's in the relationship business, whether you're a commodity business, a product business, a service business, et cetera. And if you don't understand that, and that's not top of mind, then it's really easy to make decisions that degrade or ruin the relationship. Look at the American car industry in the 70s and since the 70s, right? The products got worse and the relationships got worse. And we all know like it takes seven times the amount of, you know, money and time to try to get a customer back than it does to just keep them and not lose them in the first place.
Bingo.
We don't teach relationship tools in business school. We teach money, we teach, you know, processes, we teach quant. We don't teach qual. And that shows up in market insight as well. So you may think that you have really good market research or you're buying good market research or you have great market researchers with you, whatever. The problem is most market research is a quant business. They're looking at numbers. They're looking at things that can easily be measured, defined, and reported with numbers. Well, that's great. There's an important set of things there that we need to be on top of. But then there's the qual, and market research usually doesn't venture into the qual. So we have to invent other terms for it. Some people call it market insight. A lot of design research, user research emphasizes the qual. That's the other half of the equation that is essentially blocked out of businesses. So we're, you know, most businesses are functioning with one of their eyes closed. And so they don't even have the complete picture. And the data that they're missing most is the most important data for relationships.
Mm. So you're saying that most people are so short-sighted in the very beginning that they just need to have money that they forget about building relationships. And that usually comes back to bite them. And, well, and the more you focus on the money and forget about the relationships, the harder your life actually becomes. Is that right?
And it's not just the money, it's the other qual stuff. So it's features and it's performance. So in the tech world, like how fast are our processors? Think back about the days of, you know, computers, especially personal computers. You know, it was all about how fast was the processor? How much memory do you have? You know, how big's the screen, et cetera. Apple never played that game. They played the how easy is it to use? Can you envision yourself using this?
Yeah.
What can you do with these things? You know, I'm old enough, you're probably not, I'm old enough to know that when the first personal computers came out in like Popular Science magazine, the best uses that the engineering tech culture could come up with about why people would use computers is balancing your checkbook and storing your recipes. Like, that's it. That's all they could think of, right? It's, we look at it now and we laugh and it looks so ridiculous, but when you have a quant view of the world and you're only looking at money and you're looking at price points and you're looking at features, you are missing everything else that, you know, it matters to people. And this becomes really important. This is part of the schism between like sales and marketing. Salespeople know that they're not making the sale on the basis of a feature or a price. They know it's a relationship. They know that emotions are at work. They know that identity and meaning are at work. That's the game they're playing. But if you're not talking to your salespeople about what it is, what's turning the customer's decision really, because they'll say it's the budget and the price, but in reality, it's probably something much more subtle and much more powerful. So again, you're probably too young for this and many of you users, but we used to have a term in the business world that said, nobody ever got fired for hiring blank. Any idea who that company that was?
Nobody ever got fired for
hiring
blank. I can't think of anyone that really stands out.
Yeah, if you don't know it, you're not going to get it. IBM, right? And the point was IBM was never the cheapest and it was never the best. There was always some engineering firm that could probably do a better job than IBM. And we're talking B2B. So when I talk about like in meaning and identity and emotions and the qual part, everyone's like, oh, I can see that for, you know, B2C. I get it. But I'm in B2B. I sell to enterprises and it's all about features and money. The point about, you know, this saying about IBM illustrates that, no, it's not about the money. IBM was never the cheapest. They were never the best. It turns out the most important decision driver, and that's the key term, the most important driver that customers were turning their decision on was, any guesses?
I mean, the only thing I could think of is price, emotion. What would be, other than those two, to me, it's convenience,
well, it's
speed,
an emotion.
Speed?
It's job security. I don't want to get fired if this project goes south. And if I hire IBM and it goes south, I have a excuse. If IBM couldn't build it, then nobody could have built it, right?
Oh, okay.
Don't fire me, right? Turns out that's the biggest decision driver in most enterprise sales relationships. Okay, well, that's not even on the playing board in terms of if you're looking at features and budget. But salespeople know this. That's what they're selling. Most salespeople will tell you, if it comes down to price, if it really comes down to price or features, I probably lost the sale. Someone's always going to be able to, you know, reduce their margin or sell it at a loss, beat my price, et cetera. They're not playing a quant game. They're playing a qual game. And that's the kind of insight that you need to pull into the strategic process, or else, again, you're not really playing the game.
Wow. So my thought is the people who do best at this, like I said, the average person listening is someone who has a business or looking to start a business, or maybe they have done really well and they're taking on a new identity, doing something else, whether it's writing a book. And maybe something that I say to all of our clients is when you write a book, it always starts with the end in mind. And however far you could see yourself out, whether it's a year, 5 years, 10 yeah. years, reverse engineer that person. What are you doing? How does that person dress? What are you speaking about? And so my thought is, when it comes to strategy in your business, the same aspect applies. It's all about where you see yourself 5 or 10 years from now. So the person who has the longest and clearest vision most likely plants the seeds, puts the breadcrumbs down, and eventually produces that harvest. And that is very tough to teach. So my only philosophy is get started, and it's not about timing the market. It's about time in the market. The longer you're in this game, the more you understand yourself, the more you understand your customer, the more you understand how you can help. It's the only thing I could say to people, because that's how I learned. When it comes to vision, is there any clear-cut way, anything you can teach our audience?
Yeah, there's a couple things. Mostly, open your eyes to the things that are not, you're not comfortable or you're not used to seeing. And that may require you working with someone, hiring someone, talking to someone that has a different perspective than you do. We see this in tech startups all the time, right? Tech startups tend to build what they need for themselves, what they see for themselves. And they don't look at customers. And it turns out they're the only customer, right? Tons of tech companies fail, not because they didn't engineer well, or they make it to market fast or whatever. It's that no one else wanted what they wanted. So it's really important for any kind of entrepreneur to get an outside perspective to validate, like, is this a thing for me, or do other people care about and want this too? And we tend to reinforce and look for, you know, validating confirmation bias data that says, oh, no, other people want this too. And it turns out maybe they don't, or maybe they need it in a different way. And then once you get down the line in terms of, you know, making it to market and distributing and promoting, maybe they need to be told about it, or it needs to be described in a different way to make sense for them, so that they can see themselves as a customer than what it took for you to say, oh, yeah, it's obvious that this is better.
Now, in this, in our podcast, we always talk about the hero's journey, right? You're probably familiar with this in storytelling, where there's an individual who's in a familiar world, then goes into an unfamiliar world, then back to the familiar world to teach the others. But in stage two, there's that where the tests are, and the where you find your mentors and your enemies and your allies. So when it comes to winning these battles, slaying the dragons, I think it does require you to partner up and to have this strategic alliance with the right allies. And so I do apply the who, not how approach. Have you heard that book at all?
No, I haven't.
Who, not how. It's a great book out there. But sometimes you don't need to do everything yourself. You need to team with people who really do strengthen your weakness. So number one, knowing a weakness of yours, and then finding someone out there, or a team or a company or a person who excels in that area. And so when it comes to your book and a whole new strategy, I would assume maybe it's really about partnering up, or maybe creating an alliance with the right people. So is that a part of the recipe, or what do you propose when it comes to that?
Very much so. That's what this, if you look at the sort of, again, this dashboard or this periodic table of strategy, more than half of it is about the categories of stakeholders and seeing them all, so that you can and say, you know, I'm here to remind you basically of saying, think about schools. Is there a hiring strategy or a partnership with schools that's going to help you get where you're going? Or is there, you know, a foe that comes out of that category that you need to plan, you know, a defense against, right? So just having the whole set of categories out in front of you can really help you. Absolutely, partnership strategy is really important. And I don't think that's emphasized enough, either in business school or just in entrepreneurial, you know, reading material, books, videos, et cetera, because we have a cult of, and the media supports this, a cult of sort of the individual or the small team, like they did it on their own. Here's the hero, right? And the reality is, if you want a large, successful company, It's not one person. It's certainly not the CEO. It's not even that team and that company. It's the entire ecosystem that is in support and being addressed and essentially asked to participate in the success of that company. The other thing, when you were mentioning, like, you can't teach some of these things, I think that on one level, it's true that a lot of this doesn't come naturally to a lot of people, but I do think that we can teach it. You can, you know, learn new skills. You have to be open to it. But one of the most important, most critical skills in all of this is simply flexibility. Knowing when to say, oh, that's not working. We need to try this instead. And when I teach my students, who are mostly different types of designers, that the most difficult conversation they're going to have as a consultant or in their company is when they come back with this market insight, with this qualitative customer research, very often the answer is, oh no, people don't want what we were planning on making. And the most difficult conversation is to go back to your client or your bosses and say, hey, this isn't going to work. However, because of this research along the way, we found something better. That's called the pivot now nowadays, right? In the design world, we call that the reframe. The problem is so many people, especially in a leadership position, they can't bring themselves to pivot. They're so single-minded, like we agreed to do this and you know, you're telling me you're not going to do it now. That doesn't make sense. You're fired. And that's probably the thing that hurts most companies down the line.
Man. Yeah. And it is heartbreaking sometimes. You need to have thick skin in this game of business, because sometimes you have your heart set on a pathway, you hit a roadblock and you realize that there is another way and you were wrong. And making that adjustment sometimes requires you to, you know, to a humbling moment where you were right. You hit this and you say, well, I guess I was wrong. And so having the ability to adjust and make these different pivots at certain stages in your life can feel like it's taking a step back, but it's necessary, because this happens in every business, every industry. It's going to be required, especially with technology and all these new tools and bells and whistles. You are going to adjust. And those who are most nimble on their feet most likely win, because they're not stuck to one pathway, ultimately staying in a rut.
You're absolutely right. And I think that some people get training in this better than others, especially, again, people that come from an art, design, architecture background. They're used to having their ideas shot down and in a constructive way. The critique is really an important part of those disciplines' cultures. And one of the things that those people learn that lots of business people don't learn is not to take it personally. This thing doesn't work for these reasons. Great. That's not a reflection on you. Doesn't mean you're a bad guy or that you're stupid. It means that you didn't think of something or there's a better way to solve something. And everyone's now contributing on how to make this thing truly successful and better. But you have to sort of pull your, you have to pull your ego out of it, because, and again, a lot of people in business can't, they see it all as a personal attack. Especially if something is a failure in the market, they take it really personally. And it shouldn't be. Like, business shouldn't, there are parts of business that should be personal, and that's not one of them. So the idea of, you know, being offended or being angry that something wasn't successful or someone didn't agree, that has to come out of it. The other piece of this is that you will have many, I had a great, one of the best instructors I had at design school way, way, way back when, said one day, like, so many people in business worry, like, they have that one great idea and they hold it so fast because they don't know when they're going to have another idea. He said, all of you here in the class, you can generate ideas every minute of the day. You'll have hundreds and millions of ideas in your life. None of them are precious. And if you don't grow up in that atmosphere, you don't realize that just because you have an idea doesn't mean it's the only idea you're ever going to have. And if it's not going to be successful, great, toss it, make another idea. And that's not something, you know, going back to flexibility, that's not something that everyone is comfortable with.
Mm. Yeah, great leaders, the ones I truly admire, they are idea machines, right? They're not married to an idea. So when it does fall, they're able to pick up a new one and then keep it going. And therefore they have this skill set that Tony Robbins talks about is has nothing to do with the amount of resources you have, has to do with your resourcefulness. And maybe that's the greatest aspect of a leader is they are resourceful. They can make something out of nothing every step of the way. And one last two questions I have for you. When it comes to strategy within an organization, how important is it to convey this strategy to everyone within the organization? So one of the things that I like to say to people is like, think like an entrepreneur. So therefore they can problem solve as they go through and in anything that comes their way, they can fix that problem and solve it and also reap the benefits from it. But the strategy, sometimes the strategy changes. And so maybe you just paint the picture of where we're going. And I guess that's the goal of any leader. Let's show the promised land and I'm going to give you the tools and resources and let's go do it together. But I'm going to give you the freedom to help make it come to life with your own ideas. So whenever it comes to strategy, how much do you convey that to your team consistently? Or maybe do you only convey the details of this entire strategy to certain people on the team? What do you say about that?
Well, you cannot survive as a company and a strategy cannot be successful if it's not communicated literally to everyone in the company. Because if they don't know what the strategy is, at least at the high level, but maybe even at mid-level, how could you possibly expect their activities at any given moment, especially on the front line with customers or partners, to align with strategy? Like you can't, right? And all of the, everything I'm talking about is the most important part of, you know, failure of strategy. But another one of the biggest failures of strategy, especially in large companies, is it never goes beyond the top layer or maybe the top two layers. Nobody ever communicates the strategy. And then they wonder why they're not on strategy and why things aren't happening the way they want, right? Or only managers got told and never anyone on the front lines. There's a moment in the book that I talk about, Jan Carlson. He had this great book from, I don't know, probably from the 90s. He turned SAS around in the 80s. And one of the things that was critical to his success of turning SAS Airlines around was he had a very clear strategy that was communicated to everyone in the company. Number one is safety. You do not take off if it's not safe. Number two is on time. I don't care if everyone has the right meals or enough blankets. You take off online as long as it's safe, right? And then number three is service. And his approach was that the flight attendants, the pilots, the gate agents, that's where it all happens. That's where the airline happens. That's where his business is. If they don't know those things, how could he possibly expect to turn that company into the biggest airline, the best and biggest business airline in Europe? You can't, right? So communication is incredibly important and then making it clear. There's also people think that simplicity is the goal. Clarity is the goal.
Oh, so great.
How can you communicate clearly? So I'm going to give you and your listeners the best definition of leadership. Leaders clearly communicate a vision of the future, a vision of the company, whatever, that others want to follow. That's it. That's leadership in a nutshell. If you can do those pieces, clearly communicate a new vision, like who we want to be, what are we going to be, et cetera, that others want to follow. And in order to understand that, you need to talk to others, right? Like you need to include other people. That's leadership right there.
Oh, man, clarity is a superpower, man. I always say that because if you can speak in a way that gets people to understand and has them act on those words, you can win battles. You can slay dragons. You can, you know, you can move the needle in sales and create revenue, right? So everything is based off of how well you articulate your solutions to the marketplace and to your team. Ooh,
it's good. Exactly awesome. Right.
Great and definition.
Well, that definition comes out of something called generative leadership and also conversations for action. It all goes back to something called neuro-linguistic programming, but And this is the most important class I ever had at business school, was a class on communication, because it turns out that there is a way to be precise about communication that clarifies things. It clarifies when things aren't being covered as well. It helps us all communicate better. it's almost like an engineering approach to communications. I was so thankful to be given a clear tool for communication because that changes everything.
Yeah. You know, I once heard this stat, and maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong, but the elite, the richest people on this in America, send their kids to school, not to really to get a job, but to learn, you know, when it comes to communications. And they go after communications degrees and basically English majors, if you will, something in that field, not for the job that they're going to get, but the ability to clearly communicate and articulate your thoughts in person and in writing. And when you have that,
and nowadays online, yeah.
Yeah. And so once you have that superpower, that transcends any type of business. So
you just open, like, there's a whole conversation we could have about education, but, you know, this approach to STEM is a real problem because it assumes that the reason you go to college is to get a job, and not everyone goes to college, but you what you're talking about is you go to college to get an education to become a citizen. Whether you can get a job out of that or not, that's great. And certainly you can focus on things that you like that are going to turn into a good job. But if you don't become a functioning, clearly speaking citizen, you're relegated to, you know, worker bee. And now that AI is hitting, 80% of math-based jobs are going to go away.
Yes.
And you can go look at STEM and tell me how much math is in all of those, right? So it turns out that the quote unquote liberal arts education is exactly the path forward as long as it promotes a creative thinking, critical thinking, strategic thinking, systems thinking, and about four other things.
Jordan Peterson. Are you a fan of Jordan Peterson? Do you know who that is?
Not especially.
Wait, is that a no, I don't know him, or no, I'm not?
Oh, I know. I know him. And okay. He says a lot of problematic things in my.
Well, I'm a major fan of his, and what he does say, it really lands well. You want to be dangerous in this world? You want to get what you really want? Learn to read and write. So when you go to school, learn to read and write. Maybe the teachers aren't giving them enough of a pathway of how powerful that is. But if you can read and write, you can become dangerous. And I just love how he puts that What's that?
Yeah. He's absolutely right there. Yes.
Damn right. So, okay. Not a big Jordan Peterson fan, but we still like you. Just so you know. Anyways, outside of your own book, this is a question we ask all of our guests. Outside of your own book, is there a book that stands out in your life as, you know, a must read, something that you read and maybe put you on this pathway you're on today? I always talk about Rich Dad Poor Dad. It changed my life. So anything like that for you?
Big fan of Rich Dad Poor Dad, by the way. There's so many books. How do you narrow it down to one? I'll tell you what. On my website, I have a whole resources page that lists all the books in all the categories that I specialize in. So that's maybe the easy answer. Any one book, you know, I'm a huge fan of science fiction, and I've learned a lot of lessons from science fiction. So the books that have been most impactful on for me have all been science fiction books, not nonfiction, not business, not whatever. So
wow. And which one are you thinking of? Like if you were to go back to your former self and just say, hey, this is the one book, what would it be?
Babel 17 by Samuel Delaney changed a lot for me. And then I have to say, and again, this isn't about business, but it's about flexible, fluid thinking. Ted Chiang's books of short stories. He's got two. One's called Exhalation and the other's Stories of Your Life. One of the short stories in that one became the movie Arrival. I have never seen anyone write such original, fascinating, wholly new worlds. So if you're not into science fiction, then you know you're not gonna like it.
Man, I'm looking at this. Obviously, I was expecting a science fiction answer because of your background and looking at your books. Yay or nay? Are you an Elon Musk fan? You have to be with the way he thinks. Any thoughts on him?
You know, I love SpaceX. I love what, you know, he's done with Tesla. What he does on Twitter is just insane. And he is surrounded by yes men, and he doesn't see what he's saying is some very dangerous, stupid things. He has transformed industries, and he has ruined his reputation lately.
I will say there's a quote that I heard him, I think it was on a stage recently, but there's a quote that really makes sense to who he is as a person. I think he said something along the lines of his job is to take the fiction out of science fiction. How cool is that, right?
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. And I appreciate what he's done, especially again with SpaceX and Tesla. You know, the Hyperloop was stupid and was never possible, and he didn't put his money into Hyperloop, by the way. You know, like it's a little bit of a mixed bag, but I would, you know, if my Tesla died, I would go buy another Tesla, that's for sure.
You have a Tesla?
I have one of the first Model 3s.
Wow. Okay. Good deal. That's yeah, I would expect you to have a Tesla, right? Because I was thinking you'd be a major Elon fan for what he's done, but okay,
I see.
Guys, if you want to take a look at Nathan Shedroff's books, there's a few on Amazon. The one we talked about today is called A Whole New Strategy, and it's everything you need to think and act more strategically. And so, Nathan, is there a website or a social media channel people can find you on? I'm assuming you're on X, but any other ones?
Nathan Shedroff on X and LinkedIn, but you can go to my website, nathan.com. So,
Nathan, you own nathan.com.
Pays to get in early.
Oh, well done, man. You played the game right out of the gate. That's awesome.
And mostly accidentally too, but you know, I'll take the win.
I wish I would have bought mike.com, man. Right? I wish I would have had it, man.
It was probably long gone by the time you found the internet when you were old enough.
I was on AOL chats talking about wrestling and in 1995, 1996. If I would have known better, I would have bought mike.com right then and there. So anyways, Nathan, this has been a great pleasure to talk with you. I love what you're saying. And, you know, as long as I get you on the Jordan Peterson bandwagon, maybe I've done my job. But anyways, guys, check out his books and get in touch with him and maybe have him on your podcast. Remember, a $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.